And it is my great privilege to introduce our next speaker, the first female speaker I note on today's program. Not bad, though, because it's still before lunch. So don't worry, Actuarial Society, I won't be penalizing you. And she is Anne Cabo-Olitzhauser, who is the Practice Director and Co-Founder of the Responsible Finance Initiative at the Gordon Institute of Business Sciences, or GIBS. It's a role that perfectly combines her professional skills, being 40 years in asset management and finance, with her academic training and passion, developmental anthropology. The question she has been grappling with for the past 10 years is, how can we rethink finance and the financial services industry to create more meaningful outcomes for developing economies? The Responsible Finance Initiative argues that there needs to be a radical shift in the structure of our capital markets and financial ecosystems if we are going to address the issues of inequality and social mobility head on. As such, much of her focus at GIBS has been on research that advances more effective solutions for systems change investing, multiplier impact projects, and projects that address structural inequalities created by the current financial system. Before co-founding the RFI with Deslin Naidu and headed up the Alexander Forbes Research Institute, an initiative that looks at the full spectrum of savings, investment, and wellness issues that confront South Africans in particular and Africans in general. She also spent 32 years managing pension fund assets in North America, Japan, the UK, Europe, and South Africa. In 1992, she moved to South Africa, very brave move at that time, and pioneered the development of the multi-manager management approach of pension fund management that has become the hallmark of that industry today. And in South Africa, she founded the publication Collective Insight, a publication produced on the Financial Mail platform that provides a forum for practitioners and academics to debate the extent that we can expect our financial services industry to address the broader social, environmental, and governance issues of South Africa and Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, I was not going to do her the injustice of not reading out her full bio, so you know just who is the powerhouse speaking to us today. That is Ms. Anne Cabo-Olitzhauser. A round of applause, please.
Used up my entire time, so.
The clock starts now, Anne.
Okay. I just want to grab the thinger dinger over here. I got asked during the coffee break whether or not I was just coming to tear apart the investment industry yet again, and I said, "No, you know, there's nothing that I talk about that I too haven't made the mistake of doing." Okay, so. This isn't about, oh, Anne knows something that nobody else knows. This is really a journey that sort of says, this is what I've been exposed to over the years, this is what I've learned, and here is where we're going to be going that is going to be absolutely knock you out of your chairs as investment professionals, because it's a completely new dynamic, a completely new paradigm. And I'm really glad that Matt was right before me, because a lot of what he talks about is part of that new world that we're not even remotely ready to address, okay? Because we have to completely rethink. So what I want to do is make sure I have a glass of water somewhere. But let me get going here. So I've kind of, you'll see some of these things. And by the way, I've been speaking to this society for 30 years, okay? And you guys still don't get it, but I'm here again. We'll try some of these things. And I pulled out some of the slides from our old talks, you know, to just sort of show you the kinds of things we've been through. So in order to get you sort of out of the past, I need to identify what does that past actually represent, what has changed, and why this is a real, real mind dump, or whatever you say in here, in terms of changing the dynamics. So I'm going to take you through the journey. You can see it goes down like this. That's about when I quit asset management and then came back again. And the important thing is though, even though I'm an academic now, I certainly didn't start out an academic, but I learned an important lesson. Watch these guys, these sneaky academics, because what they're able to do is to really point out how completely full of, you know, expectations that are unachievable we are as an industry, if I can put that politely. So let's look at the history. It's my history. and understand, you'll be familiar. We're just going to do this really fast because I got to get you into the future, okay? So I started with Graham Dodd. Value was looking at how you do valuations was a completely novel concept. MPT and CAPM, wow, what's this stuff all about? You know, and pretty important to sort of start thinking in terms of portfolio construction concepts. But at that time, we had our own benchmarks. You know, they were called universal holdings, basically. And you made up your own benchmark because it represented the investable universe that you operated in, not something that was completely unrelated to you. That came into question, as did one of the most important debates that the AMER, which was the predecessor of CFA Institute, had. And at that time, and I'm still part of AMER, we had huge fights about whether to allow historical performance records to be part of marketing materials. Imagine, nowadays you hear you can't sell investments without showing performance histories. But back then, what the academic said is, why on earth would we allow you to do that if you're a member of AMER? Because we know full well it's a nonsensical, you know, thing to look at. So we have a change. We've got new benchmarks, and those benchmarks may not be represent. These are the you know, JSE All Share, all of these types of things. We have new kind of a sense that we use performance histories. And so we've now moved away from what we actually do best to sort of measure ourselves against something that may have nothing to do with what we're all about. And then we get into a whole evolution of thinking about, oh my goodness, we know about risk and return, but have we really decomposed what risk is made up? And you get into the whole, you know, Bill Sharpe, and you get into the whole Barr-Rosenberg framework where you're looking at risk decomposition, that you're understanding that when you start to put multiple portfolios together, you basically end up with your entire portfolio being driven by the market. And this tiny, and wait till you get to a multi-manager, there's this tiny, tiny little sliver of added value you can bring into the equation. And that was one of those, oh my gosh, moments where you think, why am I bothering to do this if that's all I'm doing? It's just this tiny little bit up at the top. And the diversification, this is Dick Greeley at London Business School coming out with a paper saying, why are we as defined benefit funds, which was back in the days where most everybody was a defined benefit fund, simply putting together multiple balanced managers and looking to see which one is outperforming the other, but let's stick them all together because we won't fail. Sound familiar? The problem is, if you're a defined benefit fund, what does this have to do with your liability management? Nothing. It's just a random outcome, and that's what that paper was all about. Then we get to the fundamental law of active management, and this is one of those real OMG moments, because now we're looking at the issue that hits you right in the stomach as investment professionals, and that is, can you take your skill and translate that into an outcome? And you'll notice there are two of them. There's the fundamental law. This is Richard Grenold. And then Clark, DeSilva, and Thorley come out with the generalized law. And what they're adding into the equation is the problem of transfer coefficients. And transfer coefficients is all about, if I'm operating in a space that has constraints over what my portfolio construction can look like, which is what we all have to do, then what happens is that my ability to translate my information coefficient, my skill, into an outcome just plummets. And there's that wonderful slide here, which is about when I gave up asset management, and this was Michael Mobison talking about, actually, if we look at the skill and luck dynamics of all the kinds of activities people can engage in, asset management sits really close to the roulette wheel, okay? Which was a really disturbing insight. And he said that not because there aren't skillful professionals. He said there are just so many levels that are interfering with your ability to control the outcome that what you're doing down here and what you're doing up here may not really translate into something that, firstly, you should be rewarded for, but that's a different discussion. I won't go into fees, I promise. So you come out with the recognition that if we're really talking about long-term gain, then the beta is the long-term winner. I'm not saying let's all become passive managers. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that you run into the situation where you realize that the most important decision you're making is how am I going to allocate to these different sort of economic exposures. And this is why I sort of kind of had the discussion here with Nat. I mean, what am I exposing myself to when I go into infrastructure? Because it's really, really important to this discussion. And this is really where I stopped and thought, okay, and I want you to stop and think. Because we get so narrowly focused on how we're doing as an investment professional. The wake-up call came to me when I moved over to Forbes, and I saw those, you know, projections of your replacement ratios. And I thought, what the heck is going on here? I know what I can do as an investment professional. Why is that not translating into value add? So you have to ask yourself the question. I'm sitting here in an industry where I'm, you know, saying proudly that I contribute to members' outcomes, when in fact I don't have anything to do with their member outcomes. It's really the structure of the industry, the structure of the regulations, the structure of how things are being done that's having the biggest influence on the outcomes. And that's why I end up spending 10 years at Forbes trying to ask the question, what's wrong with the system? Why doesn't it not work? I mean, I just came from a conference where I had to talk about a two-pot system. And all people were talking about was the details of whether or not this was going to have to change the way you manage money and the liquidity issues. And everybody was going to run and take their money out. And I said, you have to step back and look at the big picture of where that two-pot system, and that's just a tiny little chink in the reality that as a government, what do you care about? You care about social protections and you care about social mobility. And those companies that get to the top of the CFA Mercer Global Pension Funds Index are economies where all those buckets are filled for their citizens in terms of health and housing and education and security and what have you. And in that case, retirement funds are great because that's just a little thing over here that you also put your money into because, you know, there will be a time where you don't have an income. But in South Africa, none of this exists, not because we don't put the money in there, but because the money somehow doesn't get to where it's supposed to go. So you've got an entire society dependent on what, this is the only savings I've got. So if I hear you complain about all the admin shit and, excuse me, stuff, I'm not supposed to say that in an actuarial society, you know, and you talk about liquidity issues and all these kinds of things, please don't lose sight of the big picture. Because this is our opportunity to change the entire financial planning industry. Why? Because I wouldn't let that money out of the fund at all unless I had a financial planner sitting there and asking the question, how can I help you? You want to take this money out of your savings pot. What are you doing with it? Where's it going? How are you, you know, can I help you? Are you in crisis? And what does that mean? I wasn't going to talk about that. But anyway, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, we worked on here. The most interesting thing, though, and this was the very first talk I ever gave to the Actuarial Society, was this theme called the upside-down value chain. And what I argued, and this was back, I actually have the slide still, 30 years ago. And I said, you guys don't understand what's happening. You're the most important people in the room, and yet you have the least resource to do the proper modeling that you need to do to get people to whatever it is they're trying to achieve with those fundings. And I, you know, looked at the whole value chain. And I said, actually, right now, the asset manager is deemed the most important person in the room. In fact, and this is actually the thing that came out of the study that we did on women just now, asset managers aren't the most important people in the room because they don't create the solutions that affect the members. Okay? So This upside-down value chain is hugely important to investment professionals because it basically says there's more than just being a portfolio manager. There's a whole value chain of people that have to come to the table and have to be properly equipped in terms of technology and in terms of how they're compensated and what have you, because they are the ones driving the link between what you're doing as an investment professional and what the member outcomes are. And then, okay, now we're going to get into the future of asset management. That's the past. And that's the world that we now know, okay? And then something occurs, and I usually use this expression, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Something occurs that is so, why didn't I think about that? Again, I didn't think about that. And it was simply this. And it was a guy by the name of Sir Ronald Cohen, and he doesn't have a two in his name. I don't know how that snuck in. And he got up and he said, you do understand that every investment has an impact. And you think, of course it does. Every investment has an impact of some kind. But the question is, do you actually, as investment professionals, know what that impact is? Can you sit there and tell your client, what kind of impact did that money that you allocated here, there, and everywhere actually have? And because I know for a fact that none of you can do that, I'm sitting there and throwing that challenge on the table to you and showing you how that changes everything you knew about asset management and what it's going to demand of you. Now, I started down this path very excitedly, thinking that I could do this. You know, oh, yeah, I can figure this one out, sure. And we were working with the PIC post-Dan in that interim period. And the PIC had some really interesting ideas. They said, look, we're the universal asset owner. How do we look at the entire economic system of South Africa and ask the question, what do we want to, what needs to be developed to really serve the interest of economic growth? Because we don't have, we're not going to have more members into our fund unless we grow jobs, and we're not going to grow jobs unless we promote economic development. And the role that we had in this, and they were doing a fantastic job of measuring this stuff on the unlisted space. But the question was, what are we doing in the listed space? Because that actually represented probably 90% of their assets, which was really scary. And of course, you've seen all these old slides here from RMB and Morgan Stanley. What we saw was what was available in the listed equity space, which is where the bulk of the assets sat. Maybe 30% of the revenues came from South Africa. These are multinationals. This isn't, here we're talking, again, big mistake, saying, oh, well, if I put money into the JSC, I'm not promoting South Africa, okay? Big mistake. And we also looked at how it broke down in sectors. And, of course, you're putting your money mainly into financial services and IT, okay? Is that going to be the growth that we're expecting for South Africa? Or if we want to create jobs, does that create the jobs? And they did this nice map where they sort of said, what are the thematic areas we need to develop? And we said, fine, I can actually model this risk. I can do a risk-return impact model, and we can create a continuum of different types of liquidity of assets that allow you to dial up to impact or dial down to whatever. God, we were going to change the world with this thinking, right? And we were going to look at listed and unlisted assets, and all we had to do is get funding for this project. And then we looked at the problem. And I got to tell you, when we hit the data, we just hit a wall. You tell me how you go into the data of a multinational that's listed in the JSE and identify not just, you know, what part actually impacts South Africa? I mean, remember, these guys are putting their revenues, I'm not talking about coronation here, all over the place. You know, sorry. You know, the revenues are sitting wherever it's tax expedient, not necessarily here. So, you know, we're sitting here saying, we're using all the UNEPV data, but we can't figure out what the hell impacts South Africa. We couldn't use ESG ratings either, because those were all historical, and they had absolutely no significance in terms of impact and whatsoever. But here was the real aha moment for us. It was such a stupid thing. It's amazing how you don't even think about this. What happens when I buy and sell a share? I'm going to sell a share to Trevor, right? And Trevor gives me money. I get the money. It doesn't go to the corporate. It doesn't have any impact on the corporate. It just moves back and forth between secondary buyers and sellers. So the question then is, what doesn't create change or impact, and what does? And this would be a very controversial chart, I'm sure. Because asset managers will argue, yes, I can go in and buy listed equities. I use my proxy voting. I use my active shareholder engagement. And I can, get the agendas that I want on the table. Well, have you actually looked at the research? Have you looked at the academic research behind how effective these active shareholder engagements are and whether the right issues even get on the table? And the answer is not looking good right now, okay? So follow the research here. More importantly, and this was a terrifying thing to see, because the industry was so excited about doing all this stuff and promoting that we could go out and sell all these ESG-type products or impact products. They're selling the stuff, and then they're holding up I'm not going to name the name of the company that provides it. All right, it's MSCI, And they say, here's my scorecard. How do you look? And our biggest challenge was we had the FSCA saying, yes, please show us your scorecards. Now, remember, you're investment professionals. Is having a high rating good? Or is having a low rating good? Because don't forget, I want to buy low and sell high, right? So if I want to make money, I want to go out there and find those companies that have the greatest prospect of turning around that nobody ever thought they could turn around. Okay? I don't go out and buy the companies that have already been ramped up because everybody's all excited about their ESG score. So the question we came up against is that if you think there's an ESG factor out there, if you think there's an ESG merit to invest in that's going to change your outcomes, quantitatively, I can't find it. It's not there. What the hell is that ESG factor? It's whatever that company decides it wants to talk about, whatever the strategy that company has. I'm not dissing ESG, okay? Please, please, please. But I'm just trying to get a point. So this thing about shareholder engagement is very important. Right now, we are certainly not seeing any cost of capital reduction that comes from fulfilling these requirements. Maybe that's going to change over time, but understand proxy voting is sort of important, but it's not really moving the dial. And one of the really, really problematic things that I have to put on the table is that right now, the way we're currently structured, if you want to change the system, the pension fund is probably the weakest tool you could use, okay? It'll get a lot of attention, and that's important, but given the fact that we don't even have regulators in the different industries sort of dictating what the industry should be doing in this space, what are we doing? How does this actually work? So this is the next aha moment, and that is ESG doesn't contain a sustainability gene. But, it doesn't translate into sustainability. It's just a measure. Where are you, in terms of these tick box sort of factors? It doesn't translate into systems change. And that's incredibly important to appreciate. And this was Alan White who founded GRI, and he basically says just what I just said, that a company may rate very highly on an ESG score, but to say this is a company with excellent sustainability is fundamentally wrong. And it's fundamentally wrong because you have no context that you're looking at. Remember, those scores are company to company. They're not relative to what do I have that to get that company to in order to get rid of, you know, the carbon footprint, that type of thing. I'm being a little bit specious here. So by 2022, this is last year only, the UNPRI came around and said, actually, you're right. You know, we've got to, and don't try to read this. This is impossible. And not only that, their jargon is almost impossible to understand. They said, actually, we've got three different dynamics, three different types of portfolio management around these new ideas of how you integrate social, environmental, and governance factors into a financial framework. And the first one is ESG integration. Good stuff. Absolutely no problem with how you do valuations. You do it anyway by looking at, you know, is my company that I'm looking at to get invested likely to get into trouble because they don't, you know, haven't thought about these different factors. Then they come up with something called instrumental IFSI, which I absolutely think is the worst term in the planet, which means, okay, here's the next level, and this is a sustainability level. So achieving the relevant sustainability impact is instrumental, see if you can follow me here, in realizing the investor's financial goal. That's sort of where we pretend we are right now. But right now, and they call this ultimate ends IFSI, if you think that anything you're doing is affecting climate change or addressing inequality, think again. Because it doesn't change anything if you don't have a target that you're moving towards, okay? And our benchmarks, just remember the world that we operate in, our benchmarks don't incorporate targets. Our reporting doesn't discuss impact. We've kind of left this thing as sort of a tangential thing. And as such, because there's no value associated to it, you know, your clients, your investors, look at you and sort of say, well, that's good, but what was your return? And that's what they focus on. By the way, Croesus still hasn't recognized this three-pot, the three different dynamics. But we just started talking about this when I first joined Gibbs, and I went around to the investment community and I said, listen, guys, you got three different problems here. This is where we are now, conventional space. We're trying to move into sustainable, but if you want to get to systems, that's a whole different ballgame. And it requires a completely different set of skills. And it's, you know, what I said to Nat earlier about completely different set of risk models, a completely different set of performance benchmarks and performance reporting. So what do I care about ESG data? Absolutely, it's important. But don't confuse these assessments with Mr. Market's assessment. Because Mr. Market's going to say, oh, people have been too enthusiastic about ESG. Where's my opportunity? I'm going to go buy oil and gas, okay? Mr. Market is where investment professionals sit, and it's contrary to wherever the popular demand is. So this is a huge challenge for us because we work in a world where it pays to be contrary, and we have to move into the world where we have to collaborate with each other. We can't say, I have a better alpha in this space than you have, because if we're not all, going back to the beta, moving the dial with that beta that is now measuring against some sort of outcomes, we're not going to get there. So we're moving into a world that is really uncomfortable for you as an industry. Collaboration. And that's why I asked the question, who's going to pay for developing these models? Because I have tried as Gibbs to get everybody together and say, let's build the new level, the new generation risk model. Okay? Not a chance in hell. Okay. So let's move on. So this you're not supposed to be able to read, but it basically says that within each one of these dynamics, conventional, sustainable, systems level, you have whole different frameworks of engagements with your clients in terms of how you set the goals, allocate the assets, decide where to focus, what kind of tools you develop, and that type of thing. And we have different skill sets that are going to be required of you. CFA isn't going to take you there. CFA, is anybody representing CFA here? Okay, all right. CFA's ESG program, which I did sign up for, did look at, is already out of date. Okay, so.
Don't waste your money.
No, but, you know, it brings the conversation to the table. We need the conversation. But don't think that because there's a program out there to teach you ESG that you've got the answer. You don't have the answer. You're still, my favorite expression in this whole space is, we are building the airplane as we're flying it, you know, and that's where we are. So back some time ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I used to sit on the Future of Finance Advisory Council for the CFA Institute. And our purpose was to try to identify where does the industry need to evolve to, and what does that mean in terms of how we train the next generation up. And I thought this was pretty interesting, because this is actually, I can't remember what the date was. This is probably about 10 years old that we identified these four different areas that we had to focus on and how that would change the investment professional of the future. Now, it's probably moved over more to the ends of purposeful capitalism and fintech disruption. Parallel worlds is important because that's our global north, global south conversation, which I'll hit in a couple of minutes. Lower for longer, no more. When GFANS, and I'll explain who GFANS is if you don't know, but after COP26, basically, Mark Carney got up there and said, guys, we've got it sorted. I've managed to sign up 133 trillion rand, no, trillion dollars in asset owners, being the financial services company, and they're going to deploy that money to fight climate change. But what do you think the mistake he made was? He didn't own those mandates. BlackRock didn't own those assets. They were owned by the members. And you know what happened in the U.S. The members spoke very different stories as to what they wanted. So getting alignment here is massively problematic in the mandate space, but it gets even more problematic, and that's what this chart is all about. And this is what GFANS came up with, the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, for this is climate change only. Because they realized it wasn't just the investment professionals they had to tackle. They had to tackle the banks in terms of where they were, what they were doing. They had to tackle the capital markets, particularly in Africa. You know, if you look at African capital markets, they're really just opportunities for multinationals to get exposure to an African market rather than actually being capital markets that create funding opportunities for you know, local investments. And that's what Namibia discovered, and sort of why Namibia is sort of starting to force people into going into impact space. So this is, I can see my next speaker standing up and saying, when is she going to get off the stage? I just want to kind of wrap it up by telling you a little bit about when we got asked by Gibbs, please get up and give us a ESG basics course. And I said, there's no such thing as an ESG basics course. I'll give you an ESG boot camp. And by boot camp, what we'll do is we'll give you a little boot as to how you have to think differently in order to start going into this space. And when we did that, it meant that we had to say to investment professionals, you need to go back to economics 101, and you need to rethink economic theory, and you need to rethink business theory. And these were some points that we did for them. When ESG is taught, he always starts with Milton Friedman. We don't start there. So it's Milton Friedman saying, oh, the business is business is business, and that's not really what he said. But the important point being, that's not what we're trying to change. We're trying to change something trying to get you to think much more complex problems. So this whole idea of sustainable finance has been going for, since 1990, probably even earlier than that. There are 106 different UN directives on it. There's 33 global alliances dealing with it. There's 12 different reporting frameworks. We're all over the map. Nobody knows how to do this yet. And that's the important point. We don't really know what we're doing. We're trying, but what we don't know is what's going to be the long-term impact of some of these initiatives. And that's the scary part. Because now we've moved into a whole new academic discipline, which is, if it's not embedded in actuarial sciences, it must be. And that is systems thinking. How does one system impact on another system? So if I take this decision here, if I pull this thread here, is it going to unravel something over here? And if I don't understand that, then what right do I have to go out and set policy? And this is a conversation we had with the FSCA. Please do not do anything until we have a better understanding of what the hell we're doing. So this is what we're doing, obviously. We're trying to pull together the biophysical with the human system, with the social, economic, ecological system, all well and good. But if we're going to get this right, it's going to demand that we think differently about reporting principles and think differently about economic theory. It means we have to redefine what is economic good. Okay, and I'll talk about that in just a second. And how do we accommodate what is actually a common good problem? We're in a world that's common good that we're trying to solve for. Not XYZ company outperforms, you know, ABC company. Common good. How do we solve for that and still meet funding requirements for our clients? So what's problematic about the current narrative? The current narrative suggests, well, we can combine being good, being green, with growth. And we can actually, you know, put this all together, and it's a win-win situation. And I'll explain this a little bit better by showing you these things. You're probably familiar with the Kuznets curve, and the Kuznets curve is looking at things like economic inequality over time. And it basically sort of says, don't worry about the fact that in a developmental economy, there's going to be some suffering at the beginning, because as people get wealthier, they'll get knocked out of the system. Okay? That's sort of the simplistic way to think about it. But the reality is, if you put that in the environmental context, it doesn't work like that. Just because a country gets wealthier does not mean it resolves a whole bunch of complex systems. And so that is actually what the model really should look like. So the meta problem is that we're not having candid debate about whether growth is the solution or the problem. And look at how many conversations we have in South Africa about, if we just have growth, we'll solve all the problem. Okay? And because those norms and institutions are so pre-committed to the concept of growth, that's the meta-strategy that we put all of these concepts under. And it can't work like that. And it can't work like that for this reason. And if you haven't seen this, this is the donut economy concept, that the sky is not the limit. Now we have to work within the construct of planetary boundaries. And those planetary boundaries sort of argue, how far can I push, you know, fishing industry before I destroy the oceans? How far can I push mining before I destroy the land and biosystem? So where are those planetary boundaries? How do we model them? If you've seen some of the modeling work that's come out of Holland, the Netherlands. It's brilliant stuff. It gives you the illusion that we're trying to figure this out, but we are so far away, it's incredible. And planetary boundaries and societal baselines is the other part of the donut, that inside part. So the donut is the green. The outside where you see these spikes is where you, I know, I'm almost there. And that's what balance is supposed to mean, is getting the societal things right as well as the planetary boundaries right. The problem is Balance is not environmental interests against economic interests. Balance is, if you don't get economy, society, and ecology right, the whole system will tip over. Do you understand that? So just wrapping up, this concept of common good is really the space we need to operate in going forward if we want to recognize the fact that everything we do has an impact, and we can't escape that fact. And that's a South Africa picture, and you can see, you know the story. We don't contribute to the carbon footprint of the world. We're just a tiny little bit. So why the hell are we taking all of our resources and deploying them to trying to solve climate change when the problems are so much bigger for South Africa? How is that really going to work? I know there are people going to kill me for saying that. But, you know, so, and you can see with this one over here, where our challenges are, where we're really making the problem is on the societal level. You know that. So we've now moved into this whole climate justice framework that basically says, if we're looking globally at the problem, who owes what to whom? So if I'm going to get that $8.5 billion and stick it on my balance sheet to manage, I have to conform to what they want, they being the global north, want from me to get that money. And yet what I want to solve for may not be stopping climate change. Maybe it's trying to fund adaptation. So last summary slide. The future of investing is all about going to be integrating financial insights with the non-financial reality we live in, but these strategies can only deliver when we rethink our economic assumptions about growth and adopt a systems thinking approach, when we learn how to measure our actions. Guys, you're actuaries. We need you in that impact measurement space. We don't know what the hell we're doing there. Recognize that there's more beyond private good and public good in addressing common good, and we make sure and are vigilant to ensuring that we do not embed features that exacerbate economic and social inequality. And I leave you with this message. The only more dangerous thing than no progress is the illusion of progress. And right now, we are sitting right in la-la land, thinking we're making progress. But you can. You just got to change what you're doing. Okay, Simon.